Thank you all for standing by. At this time, I would like to inform all participants that your lines will be placed on the listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. Today's conference is also being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jackie Glaze, and I'd like to welcome you to today's Allstate call. Our discussion today will focus mainly on the FAQs that we released last week, and Calder will begin by providing opening remarks, and then we have a few speakers that will share a few of the frequently asked questions, and then we will move on to the open session for you to ask the questions. So, Calder, I'll turn it to you.
Thank you, Jackie. Good afternoon, everyone. Apologize that we're a few minutes late starting just due to some technical difficulties here with the conference line. So, again, I want to welcome you all. Before I begin, I did want to recognize a new member of the team who's joined us. Effective yesterday, Courtney Miller has joined the CMCS leadership team as the director of the Medicaid and CHIP Operations Group, so she's listening today. I just want to, before I begin, just again express my such deep appreciation for Jackie and her leadership through the recent integration of the team and, of course, in helping us organize and stand up our response to COVID-19 and just all the work she's done. I think her and Courtney are going to make a fantastic leadership team for MCOG, and I'm really looking forward to that continued partnership with the states. Today, we're going to be discussing highlights from the third set of COVID-19 FAQs that we released last week, as well as our work that we're doing to continue to update our FAQ documents and questions that we're receiving from states. We'll probably dedicate the majority of time today to taking questions as we continue to know that there's continued issues and things that states are needing to address. We are still working quite hard to produce a second set of FAQs in response to the recent congressional actions, which we will likely have out and be able to discuss prior to our next call. As a reminder, we had previously released a set of FAQs related to the Medicaid and CHIP provisions of the Family's First Coronavirus Response Act, or the FFCRA, with much of the focus being on the enhanced FMAP and the conditions applied to it. This second set of FAQs will be focused on updates based on changes and additional considerations that Congress made as part of the CARES Act. We've been working to make sure that this FAQ is as complete as possible, and we know there's a lot of very detailed questions about how some of those provisions are operationally playing out. So it's taking us just a bit longer to work through some of those complex legal and operational issues, but we're very close. And again, I expect that we'll be diving into those next call. One question that will be addressed in those FAQs that I know has come up a good bit over the last few days and that I can address now is regarding the impact of the forthcoming $1,200 stimulus checks on Medicaid eligibility. We've been working very closely with our partners at the IRS and the Department of Treasury, and I can confirm that those additional payments will not count toward neither MAGI or non-MAGI eligibility for purposes of Medicaid eligibility. Also, it is not counted as a resource in non-MAGI eligibility determinations as long as the funds are spent within 12 months of receipt. So for all intents and purposes, those additional payments would not be counted in the financial eligibility determinations for anyone, and that's the same as any of the additional payments that are available to individuals through the unemployment funds. The additional payments that are made available under the CARES Act would not count as well. There was a specific provision in the law that discounted those extra payments from counting toward eligibility. But we know that question's come up, and so we wanted to clarify that. You'll see that answered with a little bit more detail in the FAQs that are released shortly. Another update I want to provide is just where we are with some of the waivers and spots and flexibilities that we've been working on. We have now received and approved 1135 requests from nearly every state. I think at this point today, we only have one outstanding state that came in on Sunday night that we're working through. We know there's a handful of states that are either coming in with a second round of requests under 1135 authority or maybe are just beginning that process, and we'll be working those as quickly as possible. Those initial approvals, at least, are being approved in an average of less than five calendar days. Much of the work, though, I think, is turning to sort of the next set of authorities and flexibilities with, of course, that being a lot of focus on the disaster state plan amendments, the disaster SPAs, and the CHIPS disaster SPAs as well. We've now approved three of the disaster SPA templates for Medicaid, and I believe we'll have the first CHIP disaster SPA in light of COVID-19 approved today as well. Also, as of last night, we've now approved about 21 Appendix Ks for your 1915C waivers. And so we're continuing to process those as well as some of the 1115 requests and the IT funding requests that have come in. And we're also responding to states just to affirm some of the flexibilities that they have in their existing regulatory authorities. And we encourage you to reach out to your state leads if you want to confirm what other options may already be available to you under the current regs. I know a topic that continues to be a focus area for many states and for the NAMB as well has been the ability to, you know, address issues in provider solvency through the ability to make some types of retainer payments or additional payments to providers in light of COVID-19 and ensuring that we're able to continue access to care through and beyond the public health emergency. This is something we're looking at, I think, broadly across both CMS and, you know, HHS as a whole. As you may know, Medicare has been working to accelerate advanced payments out to providers, which are a type of loan that they're able to provide for several months of payments in advance. I think they've injected nearly $70 billion in additional reimbursement out to providers through those advanced payments that have been accelerated over the last 10 days or so. And then the department, HHS, will be providing very soon more detail regarding how the additional $100 billion that was appropriate through the CARES Act is going to be dispersed into the provider community, with much of that funding being prioritized for quick allocation to get cash out to providers. And then we'll have follow-on discussions about, you know, future investments of those funds and how, and certainly we'll be communicating that to states in terms of its relevancy to Medicaid providers, which are certainly an important part of our provider community. Right now, through our existing authorities, we've been working with states on, of course, a number of opportunities for these types of payments for HCBS providers through the Appendix K authorities. Also, we're, you know, beginning to work with states through the disaster SPA process, which allows for temporary rate enhancements or rate methodology changes that we believe may be able to address some of these needs. And as we develop more experience with states there, we'll provide more guidance and examples of how those options are being used. But even beyond that, we know that there's ongoing asks, and we're continuing to assess the needs of Medicaid providers and states as we receive those requests. And we'll continue to work on additional steps that may be necessary as we see more how the needs of states are playing out and of providers in light of all the things I've just discussed. So that's going to be a continued set of work for us with you all. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Jackie, I think, to introduce our next speakers, who are going to dive a little bit into the FAQ Batch 3 that was released recently. And then, of course, as I mentioned, we'll spend the balance of the time on your questions.
Thank you, Calder. So now we'll move to Alyssa DuBois, and she's going to address several of the managed care questions in the FAQ batch number 3. So, Alyssa.
Great. Thank you, Jackie. Hopefully you can hear me okay. Good afternoon, everybody. On behalf of the Disabled and Elderly Health Programs Group, we have a few questions in batch 3, the questions that recently posted. They range from pharmacy, third-party liability, and managed care. The most significant of these questions, though, relates to managed care, and I wanted to briefly highlight it for you all this afternoon. The question concerns the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on state-level managed care plan performance and quality measurement efforts. We note in the FAQ that CMS recognizes that the current COVID pandemic is likely to affect clinical practices, as well as the timely and accurate reporting of quality data. And as a result, states may need or want to revise their managed care contractual quality measurement requirements. So we list some examples. For example, states may have contractual requirements surrounding withhold arrangements in which a portion of the capitation rate is withheld from a managed care plan and which payment is linked to quality performance. Similarly, other states may have contractual incentive arrangements in which an amount over and above the capitation rate is paid to managed care plans for meeting targets specified in the contract. In addition to these arrangements, states may also have approved directed payment proposals that condition payment to providers upon the performance of specific quality measures. Or states may have general contract requirements that impose penalties on plans for failing to meet certain performance levels. States, as we note in the FAQ, states may want to re-examine these payment arrangements to determine if contractual changes are necessary in light of the COVID emergency. Depending upon the nature of the change, a contract amendment may be needed as well as a rate cert amendment if changes are expected to have a material impact on the rate. And if it is a directed payment change, a revised pre-print will likely need to be submitted as well. As we've noted before, CMS is working to prioritize and expedite these reviews, and we have a dedicated mailbox where these actions should be submitted, and it's the identification of which is in the FAQ. I also want to note that we have a special call this Friday to discuss managed care rate implications in light of the COVID pandemic. Our colleagues from the Office of the Actuary will be presenting some considerations for states, focusing on flexibilities available under existing authority. We'll discuss these options in terms of complexity and timing of various approaches. We think that you'll find that very informative and encourage states and their actuaries to participate. So with that, I'll turn it back to Jackie. Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks so much, Alyssa. So next up is Jeremy Slanskas, and he will talk about the payment and financing. So, Jeremy.
Hi, thank you. So most of our questions are more procedural in nature. We have a few questions here about flexibilities available in the event of a public health emergency impacting state Medicaid agency staff and their inability to submit quarterly budget estimates on Form CMS 37, 45 days before the beginning of the quarter. So what we say there is that that's fine. You should notify CMS if the Form 37 is going to be delayed, and we'll work with you on what that will look like. And the same applies to CMS 64 reporting, too. You should notify us, and we'll work with you on timelines there. We do have some guidance about telephonic services provided by FQHCs and how that would work and whether FFP is available. And we do clarify that, yes, FFP is available for telephonic services provided by FQHCs. We're getting that fairly frequently, so we did want to clarify that. And then also whether the PPS rate must be paid for telephonic services that are provided by FQHCs and RHCs, as they would be paid for in-person services. And so we clarify that you don't need to submit a state plan if you're going to pay the same way as you would for a face-to-face encounter, and that, yes, if states do provide FQHC services telephonically, then they should be paid at the PPS rate.
Jeremy?
Yeah, one more. Just okay. Some clarifying information around retainer payments and how that will work. Unfortunately, we don't have flexibility in the state plan to make retainer payments, but we do have the ability for states to offer higher payment rates to providers to offset losses that they might occur in providing services. There is some guidance in the Section 1115 template on how states might make some retainer payments to certain providers, and there also is the option under Appendix K to make those payments. So we are getting that very frequently, and I just did want to clarify that. And I think that's our most frequently asked questions, Jackie. So back to you.
Thank you, Jeremy. And so next up is Sarah DeLone, and she's going to share some information about eligibility and related issues. So, Sarah?
Actually, it's Sarah Lichtman-Spector from our Division of Medicaid Eligibility Policy is going to present. Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you.
Hi, all. Thanks so much. So there are three areas that we just want to flag for states that we were able to provide additional guidance in the most recently published FAQs as it relates to eligibility and enrollment. The first is additional flexibility for verification processes as it relates to their asset verification system, so for verification of resources. And that is that while the AVS systems need to continue to be used, they can be conducted post-enrollment so that a state could take self-attestation initially and then conduct and use the AVS system post-enrollment. The second is related to the question we're getting from a number of states, which is how to handle the office closures and staffing problems that are happening in some states. And there is an FAQ that gives some extensive discussion to sort of the different options that states may have, utilizing contractors that they may already have available, whether that's call centers to handle applications, expanding those kinds of call center capacity or outstation resources that are already in place. Additionally, many states have contractors that can perform lots of administrative functions, and as long as appropriate oversight functions are, you know, continue to be in place, that would be appropriate to maybe think about those relationships that states already have in play and may be able to shift and utilize some of those resources while you're addressing the staffing and office closures. The last piece I want to address today is related to fair hearings. We've gotten a number of questions around flexibility for fair hearings. And a number of different pieces of flexibilities states can put in place without any waiver or even state plan amendment. So some examples of those are delays in issuing, in holding fair hearings or issuing fair hearing decisions can be done under our existing regulations. Moving to telephonic fair hearings and putting in place processes that would allow for submission of evidence and holding of hearings telephonically instead of having in-person hearings. Those are all things that states can do without a waiver and without any state plan amendment. We would ask that states come in and request that, and we would provide a concurrence so that we can help to document those delays and also that they would be documented in individuals' case records. There's one particular flexibility for fair hearings that's available through an 1135 waiver, and that is if a state wanted to grant additional time to an individual to request a fair hearing beyond the otherwise permissible 90 days for fee-for-service and eligibility fair hearings or 120 days for managed care appeals. States can permit individuals to have additional time to request a fair hearing, and that would be through an 1135 waiver. So there's more detail about all those issues in the FAQs, and I think I'll turn it back to you, Jackie.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. So that concludes our formal comments. So, Christy, we're ready to take questions from the audience. So can you open up the mic at this point?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Please make sure that your phone is unmuted and state your name clearly when prompted. Again, please press star 1 on your phone. If you wish to withdraw your question, please press star 2. One moment while we wait for questions to come in. Our first question comes from Nicole Silk. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I had a question about cost of care for long-term care facility recipients. Are states able to increase the cost of care during the COVID emergency? We know that co-pays and things like that can't be increased, but is that an allowable increase if we get information that would increase the recipient's cost of care?
This is Sarah DeLone. Just to confirm, are you referring to the post-eligibility treatment of income cost of care?
Yes.
So that is something that will be addressed in the FAQs that Calder mentioned. So hopefully they will be out shortly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question comes from Renee Mallow. Your line is open.
Hello, thanks so much for the call today. I do have one quick question back to Sarah on the eligibility and using the self-attestation for verification of resources. I just want to also make sure that with the post-enrollment verifications of the AVS systems, if we do find that someone is in fact not eligible, given the provisions under COVID and the statutes, we would maintain those individuals in eligibility, in coverage, I mean?
That's correct, to comply with the, it would be a determination based on the self-attested information. So they would then get the protection that you would need to comply, you know, to maintain their coverage to
okay.
qualify for the increased FMAP. Yes.
Okay. Okay, thanks. And hi, Sarah.
Hi, Renee. Hello, everybody.
Our next question comes from Colin Laughlin. Sir, your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate all the hard work that everyone's doing. I had two questions in particular related to facility-based care. The first one, it was mentioned earlier that state plan services, while not available for retention payments, could be able to receive supplemental or enhanced payments, in particular for nursing facilities or intermediate care facilities. Is that something that should be submitted through the 1115 or the 1135? We keep getting direction. It's kind of moving back and forth, and so hoping to get some clarity there. And then secondarily, has there been any consideration of allowing states to utilize civil monetary penalty funds for, in particular, I think off the top of my head, COVID-related issues in terms of outbreaks within specific facilities, or potentially even looking at enhanced or supplemental payments for some facilities to keep them open if there have been positive COVID results from those areas?
Thanks. This is Calder. In terms of your first question on enhanced or supplemental payments for facilities, I think we'd probably first look to the State Plan Authority. Jeremy, do you want to talk about that in terms of the use of the disaster spa there?
Sure. So the disaster spa actually has a place where you can describe those payments. So if you want to make new or additional supplemental payments to facility providers, you can do so in that template. You know, you do have to factor in upper payment limit room, so that is a consideration there. But I think we're also recognizing that there could be, and this is covered in the FAQs that we released, there could be additional costs, or there likely will be additional costs during the public health emergency period that weren't factored into your UPL calculations, and so we can work with you on language that would keep you within those limits, but also give you the flexibility to make payments that you need to make today. So that's an option there.
And then
okay.
in terms of the CMPs, I'm not sure who from my team is best positioned to answer that. Let me check.
I think to the extent that you would intend to use those for the non-federal share of payments, that would be us, Calder. And I don't think that's permissible. We can certainly take that back and investigate that more with our legal counsel. But, you know, you are somewhat limited in what you can use to serve as the non-federal share. We'll take that question back, though.
Or do you just mean okay. using them for these purposes generally?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, the understanding, the intent of the fund is to, you know, in terms of how we're giving out grants in Colorado, improve quality of care / life in facilities, provide a safety net in the event there's a closure or emergency situation. And so wondering in regards to, in particular, I think, do you extrapolate that incentivizing people to still show up to facilities who may have a COVID outbreak, is that something where we could use those funds for an enhanced payment mechanism?
I see. Okay, we'll let us take that back and run that down a little bit. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John LaPhillip. Sir, your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, with the state of Wisconsin, and we're wondering if it would be permissible under the MOE for children to have their eligibility changed from Medicaid to CHIP. Since our benefits are identical under both programs, it's not like they're losing any benefits.
So, John, let us take that back. I think we actually addressed that in one of the earlier MOEs that was – there was a similar question that came up with either the ARA or the ACA MOEs, and I let us check so we're and see how we resolved it then, and this, I think the same answer would apply now. So we'll get back to you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jane Jackson. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. I'm fairly new to the game here, so fun times for me. My question is probably very basic, but I'm wondering where I can find guidance on or to try to verify whether or not I can use the enhanced 6.2 FMAP money to supplant any non-federal or state funding, general funds? Has there been guidance issues on that?
Sure. So I'll start and then Jeremy can probably color in a little bit of the details. So to the extent that the enhanced FMAP frees up state funding that you no longer have to contribute as much state share to the cost of the program because the FMAP is higher, there are no restrictions on what how you repurpose those funds within your budget. You're of course always, there are always limitations on what you can use as non-federal share in Medicaid. But in terms of, repurposing those dollars elsewhere for state needs, there's no limitations, with regard to that. And then we do have guidance and FAQs out on what services and populations specifically qualify for the enhanced FMAP in terms of being able to understand which of those will receive the extra funding. Jeremy, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's the right answer.
Okay, thank you very much.
Did that answer your question?
Okay. Yes, thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Bill Snyder. Sir, your line is open.
Good afternoon. I've got a question related to states' option to cover COVID testing and related services with the 100% FMAP. My question is, as we look and think about the programming and administrative costs that it might require to get this benefit online for a potentially small number of people, especially in a small state, my question is, might there be flexibility for states to report and claim those expenses outside of the MMIS and outside of formal enrollment in the program?
That may be something we want to think about and explore a little bit more with you in terms of what flexibility might be available. Sarah DeLone, I don't know if you have any initial thoughts, but that might be something we want to take offline and discuss. I think it's definitely merit to your idea that we just need to explore what, kind of the statute would provide for.
Yeah, I think that's right, Calder. I don't have anything off the cuff. I think it would make sense for us to take that back and think it through and maybe work with the state to see what will work. Yeah,
if we can get some more, maybe work with you offline to get a little more detail what you're thinking about, that might help us think through that.
Appreciate that. Who should I work with?
Work through your state lead.
Yeah.
Or go ahead, Sarah.
No. Sorry. Go ahead, Calder. State lead makes sense.
Yeah, because they're logging everything. We can track. They'll get it up to Sarah and our team to look at.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Anna Arks. Bam, your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I'm from Pennsylvania, and I think that this has been already discussed in previous calls, but I just wanted to confirm. Telephone-only services for telehealth are appropriate for services and reimbursement in the Medicaid program as long as and without any kind of SPA, as long as the service is provided in the same way it would have been as if it was face-to-face. Is that correct?
Yes, this is Kirsten Jensen from Benefits and Coverage. Yes, telephonic services are okay. And the only there are two circumstances where you would need a SPA. One is if your state plan on the coverage pages has any restrictions about, what services telehealth can be used for or in what circumstances. you would need a spa. You can use the disaster spa to, for the period of the disaster, be more flexible with telehealth in your state plan. The other circumstances, if you are paying for the service differently than you would for a face-to-face and you don't have that already in your state plan, then you would need a spa for that as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, there has been some stakeholder guidance that has gone out saying the opposite, and I just wanted to confirm for us that we are good with the telephone only as long as we follow the guidance for the spas if needed.
There's been some confusion, and the telephonic piece, I think there were some HIPAA requirements that were in place that our Office of Civil Rights have lifted for the period of the emergency to allow for telephonic consultation. There's also, it seems to be, some notion that Medicaid telehealth policy is dependent on Medicare telehealth policy, and that's not true.
Okay.
So there may be, you know, some nuances to what's floating around, hopefully, and not just conflation.
Well, I appreciate the confirmation that we were on the right track. I do have one more question, if possible. The requirements for ordering, referring, and providing, or ordering, rendering, and providing, or prescribing providers being enrolled in our Medicaid program, is that something that can be waived for, like, out-of-state ORP providers in order to be able for our state to pay for those benefits?
So this is Calder. I think the short answer is yes. I believe that's one of the flexibilities available under the 1135 waiver, but let me make sure I'm confirming that correctly. Jackie or someone else want to weigh in on that?
I'm sorry, Calder. Yes. Can you repeat that question?
I'll let the question asker repeat it perhaps.
Sure, yeah. Is the requirement that an ordering, rendering, prescribing provider be enrolled in the state's Medicaid program able to be waived in order for us to pay for a benefit for a Medicaid beneficiary? Like if a provider is out of state and prescribes a benefit.
Well, I'll have to follow back up with you on that question. Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kimberly Quinn. Your line is open.
Hey, thank you. Are states required to continue coverage for individuals who are eligible for Medicaid only through emergency Medicaid coverage for undocumented citizens or aliens in order to qualify for the FMAP? So again, we have a series, this is Sarah Dillon, we have a series of questions and answers, frequently asked questions that are coming out on that, and that question is in that batch, and so hang tight for a couple more days and you should have your answer. Perfect, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Suzanne Bierman. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is also related to the maintenance of effort requirements for the 6.2 enhanced FMAP. So I saw in the FAQs that there is a limitation on, or actually a requirement for benefits related to COVID-19 specifically. My question was, does the MOE have any other sort of coverage or benefit requirements, specifically if a state wanted to make changes to some of its optional benefits, would that be prohibited under the MOE?
So this may be a tag team and between sort of the eligibility piece and the benefits folks. So I will give a response from my perspective and then invite obviously Calder and Alyssa Kirsten to weigh in. But the maintenance of effort, so there's four different conditions, and the maintenance of effort one, the one that's sort of classically labeled maintenance of effort, is in 6008B1. And that's for not imposing standards or methodologies or procedures that are more restrictive. That's a common maintenance of effort language. It has appeared in other statutes. John LaPhillips had asked about earlier with the CHIP to Medicaid, right? So there was a maintenance of effort requirement, same language in the Recovery Act in 2008. There was the same language in the Affordable Care Act, and there was the same, I think, in the Healthy Kids. It was extended further for kids. That's the classic maintenance of effort, and that's about not imposing more restrictive eligibility standards or charging higher premiums to make it, or changing your processes that are in any way that's going to make it more difficult for people to obtain or retain coverage, or make it more restrictive for them, more strict standards. The COVID requirement around COVID testing and treatment services is in 6008B4 of the Families First Act, and that's really just around what are the services that have to be required for your Medicaid beneficiaries, across, all of them, in order for you to receive the increased FMAP. So that your maintenance of effort in B1 does not pertain to coverage of benefits. That's around eligibility for coverage. So I think the answer to that is no, but I want to defer to my colleagues in DHPG if they have anything to add.
Hi, this is Melissa Harris, Deputy Director in DEHPG. I'll also flag that in our some upcoming FAQs, we're going to look a little deeper into what it means to satisfy the conditions required for enhanced FMAP, and one of those is looking at what it means to provide a comparable level of benefits. I'm not sure if I've got the language verbatim from the statute, but it's going to be addressed in some of our upcoming FAQs. So that's kind of a coming attraction of what's going to be included there. We know this is a pretty a big topic of interest, so appreciate your patience on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dana Pettmeyer. Ma'am, your line is open.
Good afternoon. I'm from Wyoming Medicaid, and I had two questions. The first question is, if a client is currently on a Medicaid waiver program and they get specialized services and Medicaid services, is it required that we cover both types of services with this requirement?
Could you say a little bit more about your question?
Yeah, if a client is currently on a Medicaid waiver program and for some reason let's say they go over resources or their income exceeds the standard, or for some reason they're not eligible, are we required to cover both the medical services and the waivered services to continue this program?
So this is somebody who's in a like 1915C home and community-based waiver program?
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that's also a question that will be addressed in the upcoming FAQs.
Okay.
Yes, although this is Calder, I'll broadly say that in general, while you can't take away eligibility for, certain types of benefits and scope of benefits, and you'll see that reflected in the FAQ, particularly under the 1915C, services are always still going to need to be based on individual needs and assessments, right? And so that will continue. Those types of procedures and processes would be able to continue to apply, and that will be more detailed in the FAQ.
Okay. And my next question is, if someone is currently on Medicaid and they entered a public institution, and so they were going to lose eligibility in April, is that an exception to continuing them on Medicaid?
It is not, and this will be detailed in the FAQ, though. I mean, in some circumstances, right, states have in the past suspended eligibility because of the, if there's an FFP exclusion, a federal funding exclusion in the statute, that would not allow federal funding to flow while they're in a public institution. That's a separate part of the statute and would continue to apply even if they, you are not able to technically remove their eligibility. But again, how those interact will be detailed a little bit more in the FAQ. That'll be hopefully forthcoming in the next day or two.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Amy Dobbins. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'm calling from Washington State. And it sounds like maybe you'll cover this in the FAQ that's coming out in the context of continued coverage under the RESPONSE Act. We're just wanting to know if moving somebody from an alternative benefits plan to categorically needy is considered a reduction in services. So similar to other questions.
Yes, I think those types of examples are, and I think it's really going to depend on the specifics of the change and whether or not the category of that they'll be moving into provides for the same amount, duration, and scope of benefits as the one they're currently in, or if there is a reduction. But again, I think that will be detailed a little bit more in the FAQs. Sarah, anything to add?
No, I think that's right. I think that particular scenario is not one that the FAQs exactly are addressing. So if you're unclear about the answer once you read the FAQs that are there, then, you know, certainly please reach out through your state lead so we can clarify the answer for you, you know, in that particular scenario.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Please make sure that your phone is unmuted and state your name clearly when prompted. Our next question comes from Estes Stacy. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. I'm from Arkansas, and I just had a clarification that I needed for the stimulus. The unemployment stimulus payments, how are those going to be counted for Medicaid, or will they?
The additional payments that were appropriated as part of the recent congressional action are to be specifically disregarded from income under the statute. So it is important to note that does not mean that the base unemployment payment that someone's receiving as a matter of course, you know, those would the normal rules would need to apply there. But I think there was a specific provision, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, that disregarded the additional payments that were recently appropriated.
That's correct, Calder. And then Calder had talked in the beginning of there's two sort of payments that are at issue. One is the $600 weekly increase in unemployment compensation, which Calder just talked about. And then the tax rebate up to $1,200. That's sort of like a tax rebate, tax credit. That's separate. Right, and that also is not counted as a practical matter for MAGI or non-MAGI determinations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Nicole Silk. Your line is open.
Oh, sorry. I tried to remove my question. Somebody already asked it. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Pam Winsell. Your line is open.
Hi. My question was answered already, and I don't remember how you said to cancel that, so I apologize.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Please make sure that your phone is unmuted and state your name clearly when prompted. If your question has been asked, please press star 2 to remove yourself. Our next question will come from Steve Constantino. Sir, your line is open.
Thank you. Thank you for this. And this is probably a confirmation because I haven't been on our previous calls, but just curious on the enhanced FMAP. Is it going to be based by data? I think I understand it's not being based by data service, but based on when the expenditure happens. Is that accurate?
That's correct. It's data payment.
Okay. So just from some scenarios, many states are, you know, going through a process where they potentially may have a cash flow problem. So just theoretically and hypothetically, if a state just delayed, say, an MCO payment into July rather than doing it in June, that would not be eligible for the FMAP. Is that a correct assessment?
I think that is correct, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And of course, we don't know yet when the enhanced FMAP will end, right, because it's going to go
right
to the end of the public health emergency. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I just needed that confirmation. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, I'm showing no further questions.
Thank you.
Good folks.
So, go ahead. Go ahead, Calder.
Oh, no, I was just going to say thanks, everyone, for joining us. Appreciate the time this afternoon. We'll do this again on Friday, and hopefully we'll be able to dive more deeply into some of these questions with more additional detail out on the FAQ. So, again, continue to reach out to your state leads if you have any follow-up questions or need any additional guidance or further TA. And we'll, of course, continue to make sure that you're checking our website for updates as those are released.
Thank you, everyone. And just as a reminder, as Alyssa indicated, that we will have the managed care rates and flexibilities discussed on Friday. We will also have the Office of the Actuary within CMS on the line as well. So we encourage the states to invite your actuaries as well to the call on Friday. So hope everyone has a good afternoon, and thanks again for your participation today.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you and have a good day.